I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Vice President Al Gore says a question he was asked almost a decade ago when he was on the road nagged him and got him thinking about an answer. The question was, what are the drivers of global change? He comes up with six of them in his new book, The Future, and they are, broadly speaking, an increasingly interconnected global economy, a greater reliance on smart machines and data, a new balance of powers, rapid population growth and its stress on global natural resources, a revolution in science technologies, and a radical new relationship between humans and the Earth's ecology. Al Gore is founder, co-founder, and chairman of Generation Investment Management, also chairman of the Climate Reality Project. That's a nonprofit devoted to solving the climate crisis. He's also senior partner at Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers, and member of Apple Incorporated's board of directors. And Al Gore, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me here, Marty.
You're very welcome. It seems every generation worries about the future, whether it's nuclear war or locusts or the plague. What do you think is uniquely worrisome about our future?
Well, there's cause for worry, but there's also wonderful opportunity. But what's unique now is never have we had so many revolutionary changes unfolding simultaneously. That's something new. And the speed and power of these changes is new.
And the speed of power, you and I are about the same age. I mean, it does feel as if we live in a very fast-paced world. I think our children and grandchildren are much more acclimated to the pace of change. Do you think that's a generational issue?
Oh, sure. That's always been the case. The new generation adapts more easily to the world they're born into. But, you know, to put this in perspective, just take population.
Sure.
It took 200,000 years for the human species to reach a population of 1 billion. But we've added that many people in the first 13 years of this century. And we'll add another billion in the next 13 years and another billion 14 years after that. So these are different times.
But do you see population growth as a sort of driver of the drivers?
Well, it certainly is one of them, but 85% of the energy we use in the world comes from fossil fuels. So we have these massive flows of global warming pollution. And now for the first time with the deciphering of the human genome, we have the splicing of genes, the crossing of species boundaries, the creation of entirely new forms of life that don't appear in nature. We're in charge of evolution now, for good or ill. And of course, we have this interconnected global network, and people have the world's data at their fingertips now.
But you say, on the one hand, you say there are serious problems with the United States political system, but you also say that the United States has a responsibility and maybe even an ability to lead us into the future. How do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, people who spend time in other countries, no matter where they are, come away with the unmistakable impression that people around the world still look to the U.S. as the natural leader of the world. People want the values that were enshrined in our Constitution here in this city. But our democracy has been hacked. It now is influenced so heavily by the role of big money, corporations declared to be people, special interests, anonymous donors. Special interests have way too much influence now, and we have to reclaim the integrity of American democracy. They're paralyzing the ability to pass any kind of reform movement if special interests object to it.
But so how do we or the people take our government back based on what you just said?
Well, we ought to start with laws requiring full disclosure of all the money that's put into politics and limitations on the unseemly aspects of this lobbying industry that's so huge. I would like to see a reversal of the Citizens United decision that declares that corporations have the rights of persons. I think that's wrong and counter to the values embodied in our Constitution.
But do you think both parties bear responsibility for the system that we have, or is one more responsible than the other?
Yeah, even though I'm a Democrat of long standing, I have to acknowledge, of course, both parties have fallen victim to this. There are many honorable men and women in politics, but they're good people trapped in a bad system. And here's the essence of it, Marty. Representatives and senators are supposed to think primarily about the best interests of their constituents. But if they have to spend 5 or 6 hours every day begging special interests and rich people for money to buy, mount a war chest to buy their television ads, then human nature being what it is, they inevitably spend a lot more of their time worrying about what their potential donors are going to think. And then when the special interest comes into conflict with the broad, diffuse public interest, the public interest suffers.
So is that a fixable problem?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I mentioned some of the reforms that I would like to see. I've always favored public financing of federal elections. I know that that's politically difficult. But I also think there is a very positive trend that may bring a lot of solutions to us, and that is the growing power and momentum of internet-based communication, which gives individuals, once again, the ability to enter into a public conversation and engage with others and build a critical mass in support of needed reforms.
Do you think the U.S. then needs its own Arab Spring, thinking of the Twitter revolution and how powerful the internet was, at least in framing the issues in that part of the world?
I really do. I've called for an occupied democracy movement. And the problem, part of the problem, is the dominance of television. You know, when the Constitution was drafted here in Philadelphia, and even before that, Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense and published it in January of 1776, individuals connected with the ideas of others by means of the printing press, and it was easily accessible to everyone. Now, television is a one-way medium, and the average American watches it 5 hours a day, and it's filled with these special interest ads. When you see a coal ad, they're not trying to encourage you to go down to the corner and buy some coal. They're encouraging you to buy their political ideas and to create the ability of the Congress to do what they want by lulling people into a false sense of relaxation about the problems associated with carbon-based fuels.
But I wonder, too, whether TV is not necessarily taking a back seat to the internet. But certainly, there's a lot of competition between television and the internet. I'm not sure who's going to win in the end, but it's hard to, especially when there's a crisis or some kind of a political issue. In many ways, the internet is driving the conversation, and TV is following that.
Well, that's the impression that many have, but the numbers tell a different story. Even though the internet revolution is dynamic and fast-growing and exciting, nevertheless, 75 to 80% of all of the money spent in political campaigns in both parties is spent on 30-second television commercials. Mm-hmm. And the amount of mind share, as they call it, the amount of time that people spend in front of the television screen far exceeds the amount in the internet. Now, it's partly a generational shift. Mm-hmm. Young people are more likely to be on the internet, and that's an encouraging thing. And eventually, I do think in this emerging contest, the internet does win out in the end because it has so many advantages.
You owned a television station.
I did.
I mean, Current TV. Did that not give you a platform for some of your ideas?
Yes, and I'm proud that my partner Joel Hyde and I were able to win so many of the major television journalism awards. But we were an independent in an age of conglomerates, and a consumer-facing business has to advertise. The conglomerate-owned channels can advertise for free across the dial on their sister channels. We had to pay premium dollar, and so getting bigger ratings was a challenge. We were profitable every year, but we had to make a change.
And I was reading, I don't know if this was at the height of Current TV, but something like 42,000 viewers. I mean, that's really small.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of viewers.
It's hard to get ratings without deep pockets to purchase corporate advertising and to drive consumers to your channel. That was a real problem for us.
It's interesting. I mean, the current TV was profitable, and yet you sold it. Why did you sell it?
Well, because we might not have been able to continue being profitable.
I mean, it was that dire?
Well, I wouldn't use the word dire, but it was obvious that it was time for a change.
Well, you know where I'm heading here, because you've been asked a lot about this, the fact that current TV was sold to Al Jazeera, which is financed by Qatar, the government of Qatar, which, of course, is an oil producer. How do you reconcile your very forward view on climate change and the threats of fossil fuels and making this sale?
Well, I don't have a problem with it. I'm completely confident this was the right thing to do. And people will be able to see for themselves when Al Jazeera America is launched in a couple of months. They are an outstanding news gathering network, and their future depends on them protecting their reputation for integrity and objectivity. And if you look, for example, at their climate coverage, it's higher quality and far more extensive than any other television network. So I knew full well that I would get questions like this, and that's fine. But my responsibility to my investors and my responsibility to make sure that there was a net positive benefit on the American media landscape made it a very easy decision.
Something you write in your book, though, virtually every news and political commentary program on television is sponsored in part by oil, coal, or gas companies, not just during campaign seasons, but all the time, year in and year out, as you just said. Are you saying that Al Jazeera and Qatar, because it funds Al Jazeera, doesn't want to influence news coverage?
No, I think that they have been, and I think definitely are, committed to building the highest quality objective news source globally. Mm-hmm. And it's an ambitious goal, and I wish mm-hmm. them well in it.
I mean, we have used reporters from Al Jazeera on this show, so I'm not saying that they're not a legitimate organization. I guess, did you struggle with this decision on your part, of course, knowing the kind of response that you were going to get?
Not really. I did. Once I did the due diligence on the excellence that this network has established, it became an easy decision, in spite of the fact that I did, of mm-hmm. course, know that I would be asked questions along these lines. I understand that. But it was definitely the right decision.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Al Gore is our guest today on Radio Times. He served in the U.S. Congress, was Vice President of the United States, and he's written a new book called The Future, and it's subtitled Six Drivers of Global Change. He's chairman of the Climate Reality Project, also co-founder and chairman of Generation Investment Management. He sits on the board of directors of Apple Incorporated. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Is your child struggling in school? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty for grades 6 through 12. Open house on Wednesday morning, February 6th from 9 to 11 a.m. More information about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Registration now open for summer reading and writing program.
I'm Marty Moscoane. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? Since you're listening to Radio Times, you owe it to yourself to become a member. For a $60 pledge, that's just $5 a month, ask for the very cool-looking Radio Times anniversary mug designed by the award-winning Tony Auth. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. You'll be glad you did, I promise.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents its annual Wine and Chocolate Trail Weekend, February 9th and 10th. In celebration of Valentine's Day, the trail features wine tastings and chocolate samplings from noon to 5 p.m. at participating wineries. From the Skylands in northern Sussex County to the tip of Cape May, there are six different trails showcasing wines from more than 40 wineries throughout New Jersey. Full details at NewJerseyWineTrails.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Al Gore. He served in the U.S. House and Senate, was vice president for 8 years, was the 2000 Democratic presidential candidate. He's also a Nobel Peace Prize laureate and author of a new book called The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I noticed you were texting during the break. You text a lot.
I do, email and text, yes. And, you know, 40% of people who have these smartphones turn to them first thing upon waking in the morning, even before they get out of bed. I don't do that.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet.
But you do quote Sherry Turkle in this book, who has written some books and some other essays about some of the concerns she has about smartphones and our, I guess, our obsession with the internet. And this idea of being alone together. Do you see that?
Oh, of course. Everybody does. Sherry Turkle was a college classmate of mine, and I've read her books. She's great. And she has a book entitled Alone Together. And, of course, everybody's had the experience of sitting at the dinner table, and the conversation goes on pause while people look up some topic that's come up in the conversation. And often there will be good friends, spouses, others sitting in the same room, both completely absorbed in their computers or personal digital devices.
Well, it's an interesting way to connect with the world. Maybe not connect with the people that are right in front of us, but to connect with the world, don't you think, though?
Yeah, it is.
On the positive side.
There's so much that's positive about it, but there are also some negative features, and spending more time in actual conversation is good for us.
You also, speaking of data, talk about the NSA building, or perhaps it's even built by now, this giant, I guess, data mining storage facility out in the Midwest or out in the West,
Utah.
Somewhere in Utah.
Yeah.
What do you think the implications of that are?
Well, since the days of George Orwell, when he wrote 1984 in the 1950s, people have worried that the capacity to collect information about everyone could potentially lead in the future to a shift in the balance of power between government and individuals. And now that we face the omnipresent threat of terrorism, it's understandable that the government wants to collect a lot more data. But why shouldn't the constitutional prohibition against unreasonable search and seizure be extended into the digital world? The very idea that, for example, when American citizens come back into the U.S., they don't even need a warrant to check the information on somebody's computer. That seems counter to what the rights we have should protect against.
But do you think people give up their privacy too easily? They don't sort of think through the implications, enjoying the access, but not thinking about who might be watching, and whether it's a big brotherish sort of person.
Or a corporation or a hacker. No, I think that, yes, what you say is correct. Whenever, almost every time, we've been given a choice between privacy and convenience, we choose convenience. But I also think that it's now getting to a gag point, and people are a little creeped out by it. You can go right now to dictionary.com to look up a word, and they will put, without you knowing it, 234 cookies, so-called, small computer programs that will track your movements around the internet and then sell that information. Well, you know, companies shouldn't treat their customers as their products, and we have this emerging stalker economy where people are tracked on the internet. And I think there ought to be more protections against that.
And do you think there's a groundswell that believes as you do and has some of the concerns that you have?
Yeah, I think it's beginning, sure. I see some new internet businesses that now are based on better privacy protection. Mm-hmm. There's a new – I'm not invested in this company, but it's called Snapchat, where they It's sort of like some of, you know, Instagram, some of these other sites where people send pictures. But the feature is that the picture digitally self-destructs in just seconds after you send it, and you can set the number of seconds. And it's growing in popularity, and I have to believe that that's a sign that people are becoming more aware. And, you know, you can send emails, and all of a sudden you start getting advertisements based on words that you included in your emails. Well, that's you know, it's going too far.
Let me ask you about the future, the title of your book, but the future of work as you see it.
Yeah.
And you write about, and I think we're already experiencing the internet and how it's changing the job market, but also robots and smart technology and nanotechnology. How do you see the future of work?
Well, here is a very big change that we can see happening. We've seen jobs outsourced overseas, but we've also seen jobs increasingly robo-sourced, where people are replaced by technology. And this is hardly a new concern. The Luddites, early in the Industrial Revolution, smashed the machines they feared would take the jobs of weavers. And ever since then, we've been comforted with the notion that generally new technology creates more new jobs than it eliminates. There are signs now of a change in that historic pattern, because the new technologies not only extend our physical capabilities, but our cognitive capabilities. We have machines that can think now. One of them just beat the champions on Jeopardy. Another one beat Garry Kasparov in chess. And they're becoming more flexible and able to perform lots of jobs. One new algorithm that some law firms are beginning to use makes it possible for one first-year law associate to do the work that used to be done by 500 first-year law associates. So the steep part of the curve may bring more job replacement issues and the need to replace the income that people used to earn.
Well, that's worrisome if you connect that to a growing population. So if you've got more people but not enough work for them.
That's correct.
Is that – because we're not going to put that genie back in that bottle, it seems to me.
No, it's hard to imagine that we will. But there's plenty of work to be done. How you get people paid for it is the problem. And this is connected to the growing levels of inequality in our economy, because the people who provide the capital to invest in these new robots and new automation, they're getting a much larger share of the national income now. Since the Great Recession of 2008-09, 93% of the extra national income has gone to the top 1%. Mm. The middle class has been hollowed out. And this inequality is growing not only in the U.S., but in Europe, Japan, China, India, almost everywhere. This is a trend associated with robo-sourcing and the emergence of what I call Earth Inc.
But do we need then better training, more education? I mean, some way of keeping up with these technological advances.
Yes, I think we do, for sure. And the nations that have done the best in reforming and improving education have done best with this transition period. But it may go beyond that. I think that we need to look more as well at public goods. There are many jobs that are not going to necessarily emerge just in the private sector. And we have devalued public goods, and we have invested less than we should in education, mental health care, research and development, culture, art, music. These will be sources of employment in the future more than in the past.
And won't be done by robots?
Well, I hope not. I hope not.
That's Al Gore, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a new book called The Future, and it's subtitled Six Drivers of Global Change. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You sit on the board of Apple, a very successful, very profitable company, as we know, has basically makes its phones and computers in other parts of the world, low-income parts of the world, Foxconn, we've certainly read about and heard about some of the labor conditions there. Do you think it makes sense, even economically, to try to bring those particular jobs back to the United States and make computers and smartphones in this country?
Yes. And in fact, Apple has announced that it is going to build one of its computers here in the United States. And this is actually a trend that a lot of companies are part of now. And it's connected to the rising levels of automation. So when the work comes back to the U.S., that's the good news. The bad news is that there are not nearly as many jobs associated with that work. Now, I'm hoping that once again, this new level of automation will be associated with the emergence of a lot of new jobs. But the evidence thus far is not compelling. Now, the countries like China, where Foxconn is located, are also experiencing robo-sourcing. Foxconn just announced that it is installing 1 million robots in the next 3 years. So some of the Chinese jobs that are now filled by migrants from rural China to the cities near the coast are going to be replaced by robots.
Quite an image.
Yes.
And quite a worrisome image as well.
Well, it certainly presents us with some daunting challenges, and that's one of the other reasons why I wrote this book.
But did you write it to as a kind of wake-up call? Did you write it to scare us? I mean, you do have some, I won't say solutions necessarily at the end, but some ways of, I guess, rethinking some of these trends.
Yeah, no, it's not intended to be scary. Some of the facts about these changes can make people uneasy, for sure. But I've always believed we have to look change directly in the eye in order to seize the opportunity and limit the hazards. I'm an optimist, and even more optimistic after writing this book. But getting a handle on exactly what these changes are, what challenges they bring, what choices we have to make, that is the basis for my optimism.
And do you think capitalism is a positive or a negative when we talk about these issues?
Well, I think it's positive, but in need of reform. Generally speaking, we have two powerful tools with which to shape the future, democracy and capitalism. And in their current form, both of them were born the same year. When Thomas Paine published Common Sense here in Philadelphia, Adam Smith published The Wealth of Nations in England. And both capitalism and democracy are based on the wisdom of crowds, the collection of data from individual choices made either in the political or economic sphere. And capitalism is the best way of organizing economic activity. It unlocks more of the human potential with organic, ubiquitous incentives. It's more conducive to higher levels of freedom. It balances supply and demand and allocates resources. But it is now distorted by a relentless short-term focus and with the mismeasurement of value that leads us to completely exclude so-called externalities that are not really accounted for in capitalism as it's now operating. So it needs to be reformed and brought back to the real spirit of capitalism.
That's the kind of vulture capitalism that we heard described in the presidential race, even among Republicans running for the nomination.
Yeah, that's
a predatory capitalism.
Yes, that's part of it, and we've seen increasing market disruptions. And take the example of the subprime mortgage fiasco. You know, when I made my first mortgage decades ago, I sat across from a banker named Walter Glenn Birdwell Jr. He asked me all these questions designed to build his confidence that I could pay the mortgage back, and then I had to make a down payment. Well, the subprime mortgages went to millions of people who had no earthly way to pay the mortgages off. They didn't make a down payment, and it was obvious they would default, but they were all lumped together and sold into the global marketplace. Well, that's a distortion of the way capitalism is supposed to operate.
Do you think capitalism can find its footing again?
Yes, I have advocated sustainable capitalism to align the incentives in the system so that it's coherent, to get away from this short-term decision making, and to fully measure the values that are now being ignored. Pollution is not included, depletion of resources is not included, and significantly, the distribution of income is not measured. So we make growth the holy grail and equate it with progress, but when we define growth, if we exclude these important factors, then the compass leads us in the wrong direction.
There is a part of your book that I do have to say I found quite scary. In fact, I wrote on my little post-it note here, scary, having to do with the food supply. And just, I'll read a couple of things that you write here. Erosion of fertile topsoil at unsustainable rates. Each inch of topsoil loss diminishes grain yields by 6%. Loss of soil fertility, increasing desertification of grasslands, increasing competition for agricultural water. It's a list that covers the whole page there. That is worrisome.
It is worrisome.
We're talking about the food supply or the water supply.
That's right. And they're connected. And both topsoil and fresh water are now resources under stress. For every pound of grain grown in the Midwest, a pound of topsoil comes down the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. Now, we can't continue that pattern. And in some other countries, it's even worse. And as for water, we're seeing the groundwater resources depleted at a rate in many parts of the world, including the American West, depleted much faster than the natural recharge rate. And in places like northern China, northern India, Africa, this is indeed a worrisome trend. And we have comforted ourselves with the belief that the genetic engineering of crops will somehow give us a way around this limitation, but it has not. And in fact, the effort to make crops drought resistant has not succeeded at all. So we do have to look carefully at factory farming and industrial agriculture and reform some of those practices that are unsustainable.
And we're almost up in a break here, but it leads us naturally to this issue of climate change or global warming. Would you say there is growing consensus that indeed there is climate change?
Oh, yeah. The numbers collected by the pollsters confirm that. But there is this rearguard action by climate deniers with large carbon polluters using a page out of the tobacco industry's playbook. You remember they disputed the medical and scientific facts linking cigarettes to lung cancer. And for 40 years, they kept any change from occurring. And that's what the carbon polluters are trying to do now.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation again. Al Gore is our guest today on the show. He's written a new book called The Future: 6 Drivers of Global Change. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling depressed, anxious? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of depression or anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Today on Radio Times, a conversation with Al Gore about his new book, The Future, and a discussion about a new study about predator cats. Where else do you get that kind of diverse programming? That's what we do 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year on Radio Times. Please support this unique service and become a member of WHYY. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Open Connections, a progressive educational environment, supports WHYY. At Open Connections, youth ages 2 through 18 attend programs 1 to 3 days a week from September to June. guided by their principles of respect, freedom, responsibility, and natural learning, Open Connection serves as a community base for young people and their families seeking an innovative, collaborative, and process-conscious educational environment. An open house at their campus in Newtown Square is Sunday, February 10th at 4 p.m. Details at openconnections.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. And if you're just joining us, Al Gore is our guest. He's the author of a new book called The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. Well, I do want to play a 2006 ad for the Oscar-winning documentary, your documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. And this is from the creators of the Fox cartoon show Futurama, which your daughter, Kristen, wrote. Let's listen.
Stand by for a terrifying message from Al Gore.
Hello, I'm Al Gore, and I'm here to scare you about global warming. If we don't take immediate action, our planet, Earth, will become a deadly smog ball that chokes out all human life.
Good! More beer for the robots!
Quiet, Bender. We're melting the polar ice caps, brewing killer hurricanes, poisoning the air with noxious gases. Look, it's all in my movie.
You're in a movie? What do you play? A burned-out cop? A streetwise pimp trying to save his little brother from the thug life?
Yes, I play a streetwise pimp with a hybrid pimp-mobile.
Boring!
It's not boring. I'm trying to save us all from certain death.
That's Al Gore, featured in a Fox cartoon show, Futurama.
I had forgotten completely about that.
We dredged that up from the archives.
Oh, thank
you.
That's so funny. Matt Groening and his merry crew, which my daughter used to be a part of, they are hysterical. I love that show.
Well, and it what we don't have here, it features perhaps one more bright side of global climate change, quote, more beer for the robots.
Yeah. Yeah, Bender is quite a character.
Speaking of climate change, do you think we should have some kind of carbon tax to deal with the problems of climate change?
Absolutely. Putting a price on carbon is the best way to move us in the right direction. Because what you tax, you get less of. It would even out the unfair competition that renewables face with heavily subsidized carbon-based fuels today. So yes, I've supported that for a long time. An indirect way of doing that is with a cap and trade system. A lot of countries around the world are moving in that direction now. Even China has launched a big pilot that it says will become a nationwide cap and trade system within 2 years.
We had a guest on recently that made an interesting observation, which is that if we could see CO2 emissions, if it looked like the kind of smog that we have been seeing in Beijing, perhaps there would be more alarm and more more effort to deal with this problem. But it's invisible.
Absolutely.
Largely.
That's a really important point. It's invisible, tasteless, odorless. So it's out of sight and out of mind. It's only the heat-trapping consequences and, of course, the acidification of the ocean that really affects us. We're putting 90 million tons per day into the atmosphere as if it's an open sewer. And the man-made global warming pollution is now trapping enough extra heat energy every day to equal the energy released by 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs. Mm. It's a big planet, but that's a lot of energy, and that's what's making the floods bigger and more destructive, the droughts deeper, the wind storms stronger, melting the polar ice cap at the North Pole, and raising sea level.
Let me swoop back then, but do you see the government of Qatar dealing with this problem that you just described, the spewing of CO2?
They have an ambitious plan to develop renewables as their new source of energy, and that region has a vision of developing the solar and wind resources of the Middle East and North Africa and connecting to Western Europe with an intercontinental high-capacity electrical grid. So there's a lot of work going on that is some cause for optimism.
What would you advise the Obama administration to decide on the XL pipeline?
Oh, I think he ought to disapprove it. It arises, first of all, in the State Department, and I hope my friend John Kerry will be given the latitude to make that decision. But I hope that that it's canceled. The tar sands of Western Canada are the dirtiest source of fuel on the planet. And at a time when we should be dialing back on the global warming pollution, it would lead to a big increase. So it's something he definitely ought to go against.
The argument on the other side, of course, is that it's jobs, and there are varying numbers of jobs associated with this industry. Does that in any way mollify you? Or?
Well, no, because there are many more jobs in the solar and wind industries, and when they can compete fairly, and the cost is actually coming down so rapidly that there are more jobs in the wind energy industry now than in the coal industry. In China, wind now produces more electricity than nuclear power plants do. And the cost of both photovoltaic solar energy and wind electricity are coming down rapidly. And, of course, the installation of these technologies creates millions of new jobs.
Where do you stand on natural gas? And, of course, that's an issue, concern here in Pennsylvania with Marcellus Shale, with fracking, questions about water supply, water quality. Have you reconciled a position on that?
Well, I think that it needs to be tightly regulated at a minimum. I'm concerned about the water requirements and the water pollution that has already occurred. There is disagreement about how extensive that threat is. But the concrete in these wells seems to degrade at a higher rate than was believed to be the case before. And the injection of the poisoned fracking water after it's brought back out of the wells has also created water pollution. But here is another point. The leaking of methane actually can undo the advantages of natural gas. There's only 50% of the CO2 in gas compared to coal, but each molecule of methane is more than 70 times as powerful as a molecule of CO2 if it leaks directly into the atmosphere over the short term. And so not much has to leak before you've completely undone the advantages that natural gas has.
But do you think it's possible to power a complicated economy on renewable energy?
I think we're getting to the point where that will become possible. We need better batteries and better energy storage. But for the foreseeable future, we're going to have a blend of energy sources while renewable electricity continues to grow in importance and come down in price.
Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Larry from Bucks County joining us on Radio Times. And Larry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for
You're
taking
welcome.
My call.
You're very
this
welcome.
Is a wonderful show.
Thanks.
Among other wonderful shows, I'm really impressed. Mr. Vice President, what do you think about the documented energy waste in America as a means to take care of that energy waste, to eliminate it, as a bridge technology to other better means of doing lowering our carbon footprint? It's well documented that we waste 50 to 90% of the energy that we use, and if we mine that for its benefits, we could provide local jobs in building efficiency and in other technologies. We could also provide a lot of reduction in carbon footprint. It's
well, Larry, let me see what the Vice President has to say.
Larry, I think you're exactly right. And when you list the solutions to the climate crisis, actually, energy efficiency and the elimination of energy waste is the number one solution. And putting a price on carbon is another way to drive more efficiency. You know, the first oil well was drilled here in Pennsylvania 154 years ago. And the abundance of oil and coal led to an economy that was based on very cheap energy prices. Now, when the price of energy is going up, people are finding so-called low-hanging fruit in all of the inefficient ways that have tolerated very high levels of waste. And companies that really pay attention to this can boost their profits while they're eliminating their pollution. So, yes, energy efficiency is the single most important solution.
Have we reached peak oil?
Probably not, but we reached peak oil where conventional continental oil reserves are concerned 30 years ago. And the new sources are the offshore sources, the unconventional shale oil sources, the tar sands. And these new sources being developed now are much more expensive. So, yes, we reached peak oil in the price range that we were used to, but there is a lot more oil out there in these unconventional sources.
But maybe harder to get or more expensive to
correct.
Get.
It, and the more oil, the more oil and coal we use, the more expensive it gets. The more solar and wind we use, the cheaper it gets.
What would you advise President Obama now? You know, he's won re-election. He's got a second term and I guess a year or two to get something done before the next presidential election.
Yeah.
What is your advice to him?
Well, first of all, I would like to see him use the powers he has in the executive branch and specifically in the EPA to regulate global warming pollution. They've gone forward where new coal-fired power plants are concerned, but existing facilities should also be included. And then even though it's a political challenge, I think that he ought to propose a price on carbon. California's just implemented its cap-and-trade system, and it's helped California eliminate its budget deficit, which was a looming crisis for the state. A number of other states are doing the same thing. I think that he should move in that direction.
You were vice president during a very tumultuous time when President Clinton was the president. And of course, we know about all the allegations and the scandals and things that happened there. Looking at President Obama's first 4 years, do you think he's had to deal with any more vociferous critics than President Clinton did?
Well, first, I want to defend President Clinton against any impression that that's what people remember about his presidency. I think most people remember that we balanced the budget and created millions of new jobs and put the country in a pretty good situation. But your question, I think, is a really important one because, yes, the vociferous nature of the attacks on the Clinton-Gore administration were extreme, but probably President Obama has had even more vociferous attacks. He hasn't been impeached. And that's a distinction, but you know, the whole birther controversy and all of that, it's amazing that he has weathered these storms and done so well. I supported his reelection. I was very heartened by his inaugural address, by the way. I thought it was terrific.
Well, in fact, he talked about global warming, climate change.
Front and center. Right. First issue.
And that's Al Gore, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book, and it's called The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. This may be an unfair question because you wouldn't have probably the information that President Bush had at his fingertips. But after September 11th, and I'm thinking about the Iraq War, would you have gone to war with Iraq after 9/11?
No. It's not an unfair question. That decision represents, in my view, the single worst strategic and military policy, foreign policy mistake our country has ever made. We invaded a country that had absolutely nothing to do with attacking us, and it was based on false information, proven to be false. It seriously damaged the reputation of the United States. It cost so many thousands of lives unnecessarily, bogged us down for a decade, and by the way, diverted our forces in Afghanistan from capturing or killing Osama bin Laden 10 years before.
Do you have regrets that you didn't fight harder to be president of the United States after the Supreme Court and, of course, what happened in Florida?
Well,
I realize this was a while ago, but nonetheless.
Well, no, that's fine. But the idea that my team and I didn't fight. You know, upon investigation, you'll find that in the American system, there is no intermediate step between a final Supreme Court decision and violent revolution. So
those were the choices there?
Well, it's a joking way of putting it, but when the Supreme Court speaks on a constitutional issue, that's the final word in interpreting the law and the Constitution. And, of course, I disagreed strongly and didn't think they should have even taken the case, as many agreed with me about it. But it did happen, and it had consequences. There's no place to appeal a Supreme Court decision.
Indeed, and we're almost out of time here. But was that a emotionally hard time for you?
Sure, but you know, there are so many millions of people who go through hardships and disappointments and setbacks that are infinitely worse than what I experienced in the midst of that painful episode. And I'm inspired by the people who carry incredibly heavy burdens every day of their lives. And so, yes, it was difficult for me, but I had the opportunity to go forward and serve in different ways, and I've enjoyed life.
Well, on that note, Al Gore, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. His new book is The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. He's a co-founder, chairman of Generation Investment Management, also chairman of the Climate Reality Project, a board member of Apple Incorporated, and a senior partner at Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.